phantasm, the delusion of a disordered mind, a phantom, a spirit, a ghost. For nearly four decades, it has been contained, but evil always has a way of breaking free.
Tommy's gone. It's hard to believe. It was a good idea not to let your little brother come to the funeral.
Yeah, I don't like this place.
Something weird is going on up there.
The funeral is about to begin, sir.
What's wrong with you?
There's something up there. I saw it.
You got some kind of an overactive imagination or something?
I know you're not gonna believe this, but these things were here.
Oh, give me a break. Okay, I believe you. What we gotta do is lay that sucker out flat and drive a stake right through his goddamn heart.
Run that tall bastard straight down to hell.
You play a good game, boy. The game is finished. Now you die.
Hey, y'all, and welcome back to another episode of the Cult Cinema Circle podcast. My name is Jesse, and I'll be your host. So I hope you enjoyed the little new intro I kind of have going on. I still have my same theme music. However, I'm deciding I want to add in like the trailer audio for my episodes. So I think I'm going to start doing that, trying to do that moving forward. So I may have recorded some of these episodes earlier. So I may not refer to them in the episode, but I'm doing it now. But as you may have already heard, I'm going to be doing... On today's episode, we're doing Phantasm from 1979. So this film in particular, I mean, I think my history with it and my understanding or knowledge of it really comes back to the good old Bravo Channel. I just talked about this when we talked about Audition. And this was also on that same 100 Scariest Movie Moments list back from the 2000s. This was also on the list, this film. And the scene in particular was the one where the kid is in the bed. I think, what was it, Mike or whatever? He's in the bed and then the tall man is standing above his bed. And then, like, the fucking zombies come out of the ground and shit. And they, like, you know... Oh, it's so creepy. And so that was like my first understanding of what this Phantasm movie was. And then it wasn't until many, many, many years later where I actually watched it for the first time. And I mean, I've got to say, like, for the most part, I don't think I had reviewed it on Letterboxd previous, but I know I watched it maybe before I got Letterboxd. But I mean, overall, I would give this like a good maybe like 3.5 or 4, perhaps maybe 3.5. Like, I do think this movie is very interesting and doing a lot, you know. But I do think that just the kind of story behind the movie and a lot of what they're just doing with surreal elements and all this kind of stuff, it is something where I understand why people really look at this movie and they're like, oh my God, this is like a big kind of deal in the horror sphere. So I understand why it gets its praises. And I thought, why not cover it for, you know, the, it's now, I think, going on, what is it, 45 years now? So I decided I wanted to cover it and talk about it and, you know, yeah, talk a little bit about that. This is definitely one of those movies that there's definitely a fan base out there for. There's plenty of sequels as well. And we'll get into all that, though. But without further ado, we're going to move into a little bit about this film, talk about the figures, the production, all that kind of fun stuff before we get into like a plot breakdown and just all that kind of other fun stuff we do on this show. So Phantasm in particular was released March 28th of 1979, which is why you're hearing this right around that same time. So it is celebrating 45 years, you know, this year, which is cool. And this movie was distributed by Avco Embassy Pictures, and it has a runtime of about 89 minutes. So it gets in and gets out, and we're looking at an estimated budget of about $300,000. So that's what we're looking at in terms of that. I don't really have any particular... So the box office information I have is really only the domestic and slash worldwide like numbers, which we're looking at about maybe $11,988,469. Or we also see maybe perhaps, depending on the website you go on, it says like... 6.8 million or something. But needless to say, it did end up doing decent in the box office realm, which is, I think, then why they had a bunch of sequels after this, because it ended up getting this kind of fan base, or at least people who were interested in seeing the movie. Because it was a low-budget movie, like, very much so. So that's something with that. In terms of any critical response, so in terms of critic response, we have 74% on Rotten Tomatoes, with about 50 reviews from critics, and then a 67% audience score with about 10,000 ratings. And then on Letterboxd, the voice of the people, this movie sits at about a 3.4 out of 5 all on Letterboxd. So that's a little bit about that. So to talk a little bit about this movie, we do have to talk about the crew of the movie. And literally the crew of this movie is kind of just Don Coscarelli, who we'll get into and talk about. He literally directed the movie. He wrote it, edited it, he shot it. And a lot of these other people, I guess we'll talk about that too, like Kate Coscarelli, who I guess is his sister, was the production designer. But a lot of these people, I don't think they went on and had like the craziest of careers, maybe working for Don Coscarelli on the other Phantasm movies or a few other things. But I mean, in terms of like, let's see. So... oh, the composer of this movie, he worked on a couple different things, like Phantasm 2 and Phantasm 3. He also worked on Soylent Green as well, the composer. That is Fred Myro. Like Robert J. Litt, he did like the sound for Seven. He did Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He did Star Wars, you know, a little something or other. And there's probably a reason for this, because Don Coscarelli did have like, I think some a little bit connections. But yeah, like a fair amount of these people, though, I think really didn't have like a ton of other credits, honestly, from what I can kind of gather, or what I at least see on my end. So that's just me. But yeah, but it was because this was kind of a grassroots thing in a way. It was very independent and locally independent. So yeah, but we'll talk about that when we get to our talk about Don Coscarelli. To talk a little bit about the characters of the movie, so you have the tall man, who's played by Angus Scrimm. Angus Scrimm is, he's been in Chopping Mall, right in the beginning, and an uncredited cameo, by the way. He's been in all the other Phantasm movies, obviously, as the tall man. He was also in Wishmaster, and the movie John Dies at the End. He was also in Subspecies as well, and he also had a recurring role on the ABC crime spy drama Alias, which is kind of cool, with Jennifer Garner. He unfortunately passed away in 2016, but he's kind of was this horror icon from being in this movie. We then have A. Michael Baldwin, no relation to the Baldwin brothers, but he mostly has just been in these movies, really. He was in the first, I think, like... He's been in all of them, I think, so that's kind of crazy. But yeah, it makes total sense. Of course he did. Bill Thornberry, or Thornberry, he was in a bunch of these movies as well. Technically, I think probably just with archival footage. If you know, you know, obviously. So that's kind of what he's been known for. Reggie Bannister, funny enough, he has kind of went on and done, obviously, these Phantasm movies, but he has kind of made that his, you know, part of his career. He was also in Bubba Hotep, which was another Don Coscarelli film. He was also in Wishmaster as well. So kind of cool that, you know, he was able to kind of have this other career. And I'm sure also he's been able to do the convention circuit and all that kind of stuff, you know, which I think is really interesting. And I think that's pretty great. And then, like, not really a whole lot else to kind of share in terms of these particular actors or anything. Yeah, again, these were all people who were kind of so sourced locally. So there isn't much to share about that. But yes, so we talked about the critical response, talked about the box office, talked a little bit about the cast and the crew of this movie. But we're now going to dive just a little bit into, you know, how did this movie exactly get made? And to talk about that, we do have to talk about the man of the hour, Don Coscarelli. So he was born in Libya, but he ended up settling in Southern California with his family. So his family was not connected to the business by any means, but he was interested in filmmaking from an early age. And he was like making movies with his neighborhood friends in Los Alamitos, California. And at the age of 19, he became the youngest director to have a feature film distributed by a major studio when he sold this independently produced drama, Jim, the World's Greatest, to Universal Pictures. So this movie in particular, I don't really know exactly what it was completely about. I'm not going to go into the whole like plot of it if you really want to look, but it's about, I think, this teenager who is pretty much having to take care of his family that's like falling apart around him, it seems like. But this was his first collaboration with a gentleman by the name of Lawrence Rory Guy. Okay. And this guy, if you don't know who that sounds like, well, that is the real name of who would then end up being known as Angus Scrimm. So a little bit about Angus Scrimm. I already talked about him being in the Phantasm movies. If you didn't already know this as well, he's also a Grammy Award winner before his passing. So he actually is from Kansas. He went to the University of Southern California, where he majored in drama. He was initially actually a journalist and wrote and edited for the TV Guide, Cinema Magazine, the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, and other publications. He also worked for Capitol Records, where he wrote liner notes. Now, for anybody who doesn't know what those are, back in the day when you used to get like records, or you used to get like a CD, a compact disc, it used to come with liner notes. It used to come with sleeve notes, album notes. So you would like have this little booklet where it would talk about the discography of the band or artist. It would have like the track listing, and it would have like different like essays or like think pieces or whatever that were put in this little booklet or whatever. Like maybe anecdotal stuff or just like fun little interviews maybe, or whatever the hell, right? And so he actually did a lot of these liner notes for like LPs and CDs for artists like Frank Sinatra, the Beatles, all this kind of stuff. And he actually won his Grammy in 1974, I think it was, for him actually having done it was actually 1970. Oh, no, it was 1974. Yeah, they were in 75. It was for the 74 season. So it's kind of cool. But yeah, he won an Oscar. Not an Oscar. Oh, my God. He won a Grammy back in those days. So I thought that was kind of cool before he blew up. But yeah, a little bit about Angus Scrimm in that way. But yeah, so, you know, but also on that same movie, I believe that also Reggie Bannister was in there. So again, this is just somebody who he knew that he was able to bring on. So that's enough about him. Like, but that's this guy. And, you know, but the idea for Phantasm was really developed from a nightmare that he had had as a teenager, where he was chased down a long corridor by a flying chrome spear, which he feared would then drill his brain out. So after seeing the audience's reaction to some jump scares that he put in a movie he did called Kenny and Company, which also had Reggie Bannister in it, Coscarelli, who was the writer and director of the film, decided to do a horror movie next. So his previous films had not really performed well, and he heard that horror films were always successful, and branching into horror allowed him to combine his like childhood love of the genre with just better business prospects, which again is kind of true. Like, you know, horror sometimes just does good because people will still go out and see it, as opposed to some other genres where some people are not going to go out and just see like some mid rom-com or like whatever, you know what I mean? The original idea was inspired by Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury. I'm not going to get into what that story is. You can look it up if you want to, but that's part of where it was inspired from. And he actually, Don Coscarelli, had initially sought to adapt that story into the film, but the license had already been sold and they weren't going to be able to do that. The theme of a young boy's difficulty convincing parents of his fears were influenced by the movie Invaders from Mars, and also Dario Argento's Suspiria and its lack of explanations was another influence on Coscarelli for this film. The soundtrack was influenced by Goblin, which went on and they did like Suspiria, but they also did other Giallo movies, I believe, and Mike Oldfield as well. The synthesizers used for the film were so primitive that it was often difficult to actually reproduce the same sound twice. And when writing the film's conclusion, which we'll get to, Coscarelli initially wanted to shock audiences and, quote, send people out of the theater with a bang. So in regards to filming this movie, there were no accountants on the set, so you know there is no official numbers, but Coscarelli estimates that the budget was about $300,000. Funding for the film came in part from Coscarelli's dad, who is credited as the film producer. Additional funding came from like doctors and lawyers. His mom did some of the special effects, the costumes, and the makeup. The cast and the crew were mainly like friends and aspiring professionals, and due to their inexperience, they didn't realize that, like, for example, firing off blanks could be like dangerous. So for example, like Coscarelli's jacket caught on fire from like the blank of a shotgun, for example. But casting was really based on previous films that Don had done, and because he could not hire to bring on an editor or a cameraman, he just did those things himself. So, you know, one band, one sound kind of a thing. The filming was done on weekends a lot of the time, and sometimes lasted like 20 days, 20 hours a day, over the course of more than a year, which is crazy. Reggie Bannister has described the production as, quote, flying by the seat of our pants. The actors would be called to perform their scenes or picked up as soon as they were available. Bannister did a lot of his own stunts, for example. And although this movie is set in Oregon, technically, a lot of this was done in the San Fernando Valley in Chatsworth, California. The script changed often during the production, and Bannister says that he actually never saw a completed copy of this script. Instead, they worked like scene by scene in this movie and also used improvisation. The script was characterized by Coscarelli as, quote, barely linear, which fair. And while it contained the basic concepts of the completed film, the script was unfocused and rewritten during filming. So the spheres come from actually one of Coscarelli's nightmares, but the initial idea did not involve drilling. Will Green, actually, funny enough, an elderly metal worker, he actually fashioned the iconic spheres, but he never actually got to see the film because he passed away before it was released, unfortunately. One of the other things that people talk about when it comes to this film is how it's a bit of a car movie, because Jody, the older brother, he drives around in a black 1971 Plymouth Barracuda, which looks pretty boss. This was used because Coscarelli knew someone in high school who drove one. He realized that he could get his hands on one by using it in the film. And also, like, an ice cream shop on Main Street was actually filmed in the outskirts of San Diego County in Julian, California. And then post-production took about another 6 to 8 months. So the first test screening was poorly received due to the length of the film. And Coscarelli said that he erred in adding too much character development, which just needed to be edited out. And then Phantasm's Fractured Dream Logic was also due in part to extensive editing. During shooting, they did not have a clear idea of the ending. So several endings were actually filmed, and one of them was reused in Phantasm 4 Oblivion. Coscarelli attributed the freedom to choose from among these endings to his independent financing, which is really what it comes down to a lot of, because he didn't have to completely answer to people. He had to answer to his dad, I guess, but he didn't have to answer to, like, you know, these big wigs, right? Like, he didn't have to answer to studio execs while he was filming like that, you know, maybe after the fact, obviously, but, you know, but that's kind of interesting. So in terms of the release of this movie, to solicit outside opinions, he actually paid a audience to watch an early cut of the film. Although Coscarelli did call the result, quote, a disaster, he was encouraged by the audience's reaction to the film. So the financial success of the film Halloween, released the year prior to this one, convinced Vice President of Marketing at AFCO Embassy Pictures, gentleman by the name of Robert Rehm, to purchase Phantasm for distribution. And this was released, like I said, March 28th of 1979 in both California and in Texas. And actually, it was alternatively titled The Never Dead to avoid confusion of a movie that already existed in Australia called Phantasm, which was a softcore porn movie. Some reception of this, of the movie. So, for example, we have Charles Champlin of the Los Angeles Times, who deems the film, quote, a smooth and terrifically impressive technical achievement, a sort of jeu de spook, with all manner of eerie and shocking special effects. In a mostly negative review from Roger Ebert, he described the film as a, quote, labor of love, if not a terrifically skillful one, but admitted Phantasm has a good visual style and sense of pacing. But he didn't really like the movie overall, I don't think. Trevor Johnston of Time Out called the film a, quote, surprisingly shambolic affair whose moments of genuine invention stand out amid the prevailing incompetence. David Carr of the Chicago Reader describes it as, quote, spotty and, quote, effective here and there, though he did praise Coscarelli's raw ability, though. Vincent Cabney of the New York Times compared it to a ghost story told by a bright, imaginative 8-year-old. He concluded that it is, quote, thoroughly silly and endearing. Variety gave it a positive review and highlighted the use of both horror and humor. And Tim Pullian, who is the writer for Monthly Film Bulletin, described the film as a dilapidated Z movie with, quote, singularly unconvincing apparitions and contraptions, and that the film does not have, quote, anything resembling a coherent plot in the course of all the fumblingly juvenile malarkey. But then you have some other folks who, you know, there's a retrospective of this. So the consensus on Rotten Tomatoes, for example, reads, Phantasm adds visual clarity to the first installment in one of horror's most enduring and endearingly idiosyncratic franchises. Kim Newman of Empire called it an incoherent but effective horror picture that, quote, deliberately makes no sense, and rated it 4 out of 5. Scott Weinberg of FearNet, y'all remember FearNet, but stating that the acting is indie style raw and special effects are sometimes poor, but the originality and boldness make up for it. Steve Barton of Dread Central, he gave the film a 5 out of 5, calling it a masterpiece and, quote, one hell of a scary movie. And John Squires from Bloody Disgusting rated it 4 out of 5, calling it truly original and writing that it imbues in its viewers is a sound profound sense of dread. And then John Kenneth Muir, who I think we'll be hearing from a little bit in another part, is he called the film striking, distinctive, and original. And Muir stated that the film has become a classic and The Tall Man is a horror film icon. And yeah, so we'll get to kind of the legacy in a little bit, but we'll talk a little bit about just like how you know, this movie's been analyzed. So the same guy, John Kenneth Muir, he interprets the film as being about mourning and death. Many of the film's fans are young boys who are aged 10 to 13. And according to Angus Scrim, the film, quote, gives expression to all their insecurities and fears. Scrim states that the theme of loss and how by fantasizing about death, the young protagonist deals with the deaths and his family drives the story. Coscarelli identifies it as a, quote, predominantly male story that young teens respond to. And Scrim explains the popularity of the film as fans responding to themes of death and the tall man himself representing death. Muir describes the tall man as embodying childhood fears of adults and states that the tall man wins in the end because dreams are the only place where death can be defeated. American views on death are another theme. Don Coscarelli in an LA Times article is quoted as saying, I had a compunction to try to do something in the horror genre, and I started thinking about how our culture handles death. It's different than in other societies. We have this central figure of a mortician. He dresses in dark clothing. He lurks behind doors. They do procedures on the body we don't know about. The whole embalming thing. If you ever do any research on it, it's pretty freaky. It all culminates in this grand funerary service production. It's strange stuff. It just seems like it would be a great area in which to make a film. And then dreams and surrealism are also important elements of Phantasm. So Mark Savlov of the Austin Chronicle compares Phantasm to the works of like Alejandro Jodorowsky, who he did like El Topo and The Holy Mountain. And then also Luis Buñuel, who was also like a avant-garde surrealist as well. He was a filmmaker, you know, Spanish Mexican filmmaker, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, so that's a little bit about that. But yeah, and in terms of like the legacy that this movie has had, this has become a cult film. Coscarelli attributing its cult following to nostalgia because this is an earlier work, but also its lack of clarification, as repeated viewings of the movie can leave fans with different interpretations. In 2007, USA Today praised the film for, quote, the touching portrayal of two brothers in danger, an iconic villain in the tall man, and a floating metallic sphere that's a death dealing weapon. This was voted 25th on the 100 Scariest Movie Moments, like I said earlier. Time Out London put it as 75 on their list of 100 Best Horror Films. Joe Bob Briggs included it in his 25 Scariest DVDs Ever list. And yeah, even some things like, for example, like the name of Star Wars The Force Awakens villain, Captain Phasma, was chosen as a reference to Phantasm. Director, if you know him, J.J. Abrams, he said that Phasma I named because of the amazing chrome design that came from Michael Kaplan's wardrobe team. It reminded me of the ball in Phantasm, and I just thought Phasma sounded cool. So, you know, it did come from that. And in 2014, USA Today quoted of Jovanka Vukovic, editor-in-chief of Room Morgue at the time, as stating that Supernatural, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and One Dark Night, hey, One Dark Night, I love you as a movie, were all influenced by Phantasm, and folklore, horror stories, and The Slender Man all identify the tall man as an influence on the internet-based character of The Slender Man. And yeah, a couple other different things. And like, for example, Don Coscarelli, he won award at a little film festival right after this movie came out, and also was nominated for a Saturn Award for Best Horror Film in 1980. And then also Mr. Angus Scrim was put into the Fangoria Hall of Fame in 1993 for his iconic portrayal of the tall man. But yeah, that's a little bit about the production, kind of how this movie has had its own life, which I thought is really cool. And yeah, just a little bit about that. But let's break down a little bit of this plot so we could talk about it. All right, so While having sex in Morningside Cemetery, Tommy is stabbed by a woman who is actually the tall man, the Morningside mortician in another form. At the funeral for Tommy, his friends, Jody and Reggie, believe that he committed suicide. Jody's 13-year-old brother, Mike, secretly observes the funeral and sees the tall man placing Tommy's heavy casket, seemingly with little to no effort, back into the hearse instead of completing the burial. Mike then goes to a fortune teller and tells her what he saw. She has him stick his hand in a box, and at first something seems to grab it, but then he removes it unharmed. Later, Jody is seduced by the woman in lavender and taken to the cemetery to have sex. However, they are interrupted by Mike, who has been following Jody and has been driven out of his hiding place by a short hooded figure. Mike tries to tell Jody about the hooded figure, but Jody dismisses the story. At the mausoleum, Mike is then chased by a silver flying sphere and accosted by a caretaker, but escapes when the sphere in question kills the caretaker. He then flees the tall man, and as Mike slams the door to get away, the tall man's fingers get caught and then cut off, but continue to move, dripping like yellow ichor or blood. Taking one of the fingers with him, he escapes the mausoleum and goes home. The still moving finger is enough to convince Jody about Mike's stories, and before Jody can bring the finger to the sheriff, it transforms into a flying insect. Reggie, who witnesses the finger turned insect attack them, joins the brothers in their suspicions. So Jody goes to the cemetery alone, but is chased away by dwarves and a seemingly driverless hearse. He is rescued by Mike in Jody's Plymouth Barracuda, and running the hearse off the road, they discover that it was driven by one of the hooded figures, which is a reanimated and shrunken down Tommy, their friend from earlier, who they hide in Reggie's ice cream truck. So Reggie and Jody resolve to defeat the tall man, while Mike is hidden at an antique shop that is owned by Jody's friends Sally and Sue. There, Mike discovers an old photograph of the tall man and insists on being taken home. On the way, Mike, Sally, and Sue come across the ice cream truck overturned, and they're then attacked by a mob of hooded dwarves, and Mike manages to escape, presuming that the girls and Reggie are dead. So Jody goes to the mausoleum to kill the tall man, first locking Mike in his bedroom for safety, and Mike escapes but then runs into the tall man, who was waiting for him outside his front door. He kidnaps Mike in a hearse, but Mike escapes and causes the hearse to strike a pole and explode. Looking for Jody in the mausoleum, Mike is targeted by the silver sphere until Jody destroys it with a shotgun. Mike and Jody are reunited with Reggie, and together they enter a brightly lit room, which is filled with canisters containing more dwarves. Mike catches a brief glimpse through a portal, seeing a red-hot world where the dwarves are toiling as slaves. A sudden power outage separates the trio, and left alone in the room, Reggie activates the portal, creating a powerful vacuum for which he narrowly escapes. In the ensuing storm, Reggie is stabbed by the woman in lavender, while Jody and Mike flee and the mausoleum vanishes. So Jody devises a plan to trap the tall man in an abandoned mine shaft. The tall man then attacks Mike at home and chases him outside, where he eventually falls into the mine shaft and is buried under a avalanche of rocks triggered by Jody. So you think, oh, okay, saves the day, right? After this, though, Mike wakes up in his bed, still worried about the tall man. Reggie, who's still alive, tells Mike that he had had a nightmare, that Jody died in a car wreck, and proposes a road trip. And when Mike enters his bedroom to pack, the tall man appears and hands crash through his bedroom mirror, pulling Mike inside. Dun, dun, dun. So, yeah, that is the plot of Phantasm. And so, yeah, it was all a dream. Ooh. Yeah, so that's kind of one of the overarching, like, I think, criticisms of the movie is that, like, really, bitch, like, it's all a dream. Are you kidding me? Like, what? But, you know, I see why that could be kind of like a little bit edging, if you will. Like, you know, what the hell, like, what are we doing? Yeah, but I think if anything, like, it kind of just lends itself, obviously, because it's all a dream. It lends itself to just the dreamlike state of this whole movie, which I do think is kind of a positive of the film, because it really does make you feel like there is just a certain atmosphere that this movie has where it is just like, what is real? What is not? Like, you know, and just some of the shit that goes on, you know, and the surreal nature of it, you know? And I think that's really kind of the thing about this movie that I think people really enjoy is just like, it feels like you're in a dream. So for it to be a dream all along kind of makes some sense. Again, it can feel like a cop-out for sure. And I'm not exactly the biggest fan of, like, it was all a dream kind of a thing. But, like, I do think that this was one of those movies that was able to do it in a way that wasn't too bad, I guess. Wasn't too mad at it. So, and I also think it probably has to do with the restoration that they did. But I think this movie just looks very good, just in its remastered state. I guess I don't know what it looks like when it actually came out, but like, it just looks real good. And obviously Don Coscarelli did something right in terms of being able to shoot it in a way that can still look pretty decent after you remastered it. Cause he shot this on film, obviously, cause that's what you had back in 1978 when you were doing this. Right. So yeah, but I guess some like particular like scenes that maybe like point out or shout out at me, I guess I would say, the big ones for me are definitely like, well, that one scene where, you know, Mike has the nightmare where the tall man is standing above his bed and like the people come from above the grave or whatever. That's fucking creepy. But a lot of that just imagery in the mausoleum, I feel like, is just really creepy and weird. And it's just very off-putting. So, in the way it's supposed to be, like, it just is, it just looks like creepy as hell. I can understand why, whoever I talked about earlier claimed that One Dark Night kind of had a little bit of influence. Cause it feels like it a little bit because, you know, that movie is fucking crazy. Oh, don't worry. I want to cover it one day. But yeah, just the fact that takes place in a mausoleum and like this one takes place in a mausoleum, you know, definitely I could see the vision for sure. But yeah, I just feel like a lot of those scenes that take place in the mausoleum, the crypt, is just like, I don't know, it's very striking and interesting, to say the least. I would also say that really any of the, I really also tend to enjoy when the brothers end up getting together and they kind of join forces. I think that is pretty well done. I do believe these guys as brothers. They may not be the strongest actors necessarily or anything. I mean, who am I to judge? But like, you know, I kind of am. but again, also like, I think they did a decent job, and I did care about these characters. I wanted them to really be able to kind of come together and support one another as brothers. So I thought that was very important to have. And I believe their relationship. And I think a lot of it, like, especially with Phantasm, this movie is a lot about just vibes in general. I know that's so weird to say, but like, it is kind of true though. It's very much like this movie is fucking weird as hell. It feels like a weird dream nightmare thing, but also it's like, it really is a movie that is all about the vibes. One of my little scenes I really like, near the beginning is after this whole funerals happened for Tommy, you have Reggie comes over to Jody's house and they're just having like a little jam session, and the jam session might have taken a little bit longer than it needed to, but I'm actually okay with it though, like totally fine with it, because yeah, they just, it feels like this movie in particular, like, it feels like these folks, you know, at least tried to have the best time that they could. especially when we talk about like how this was shot. And really, I don't think Don Coscarelli had like a particular handle on what the story was going to be. He didn't have like, you know, the vision of like, this is how it's going to end. And this is all this. He kind of was making it as, to, you know, it went on, really, it seems like. And you can kind of see that, but I don't think that's a complete detriment to me. If anything, I don't really mind it because that's kind of how it is supposed to be, I guess. Like, it does feel like this is supposed to be this like weird dream nightmare thing going on. So I can't really say like, you know, oh, well, I didn't like the fact that, you know, I mean, I guess I could say that like, oh, well, I don't like the fact that it just feels like this is so pieced together. It's like, well, yeah, it kind of was. I really just think this whole movie came about because some guy who just happened to have like wealthy parents, I guess, was able to make a movie. But if anything, like he took that money he was able to get and really made it stretch. I think it really feels like it did. But he was able to make something that, you know, I think was really kind of unique for the time, honestly. And I really thought that was pretty cool. In terms of like the cast or anything, I mean, in terms of like Mike or Jody, so I mean, either of these characters, I do think that like Mike is kind of like, I'm sure that a lot of, especially young guys who maybe really like this movie, who liked it at that time, and then who just grew up to be older guys that like this movie. But like, I think he's your one who you can kind of latch onto and root with, you know? And obviously he's been in some of the other movies as well, some of the other sequels. But I think that if anything, he does feel like, he feels just like a regular teen kid. He's on the precipice of becoming a teenager, I think. He's right in that same... He's 13, I think. So he's right there. He's an early teenager. And I think all he wants to do is be with his brother after this horrible event with his parents where they died. And, you know, he just wants to have that family and not just be kind of shipped off, which is, I think, why he's so worried, obviously. And I believe that. Yeah. And with Jody, you know, he is, if anything, he's just scared of, I think he's more so just like, I mean, obviously we find out it's the Bruce Willis where he's been dead the whole time. But like, I think with this though, like it is very much like the not wanting to, he's not comfortable with the responsibility of being taking care of his younger brother after his parents die. So, you know, if anything, like he's, which is, I'm sure, a real thing, you know, like, just look at Party of Five. You know what I mean? Like those older siblings weren't exactly planning to have to take care of their younger siblings, but they did. So I think I can definitely see that for sure. And I think Bill Thornbury did do a pretty decent job at being able to kind of show that. But he also, like I said, I really do believe them as like brothers because it's their job to be actors, I guess. But I just really do kind of appreciate their relationship, and which is all the more crazy if you've never seen this before, when the end comes and you're just like, oh, wait, this has been a dream the whole time. This guy's been fucking dead. But if anything, like, I guess that this is kind of a manifestation of what Mike would have just wanted from his brother, you know, and it's this kind of ideal situation where him and his brother can kick this, you know, alien's ass pretty much. Right. But yeah, that's about our, you know, human characters, at least those brothers. I think with this, like, you know, tall man, the Angus Scrimm character, you know, I really feel like if anything, so after being intimidated by Scrim on the set of a different movie, Coscarelli decided that he would make a great villain. Initially, Scrim had little input into the character, but he made more of a contribution as Coscarelli began to trust his instincts. So, for example, Scrim was outfitted in lifts, like platform shoes, and a suit that was too small for him in order to make him seem even taller and skinnier. And Coscarelli says of Scrim, quote, "I really didn't have any idea that he would take it to the level that he did. I could see that it was going to be a very powerful character." And with the tall man, I mean, he is like a, I guess technically a, alien. He's a, I don't even know, something like that. But he is, you know, here to whoop some ass pretty much. So, but he is also very much somebody who I could understand why people are scared of him, or how they would have been scared of him as a kid, because he's just a freaky looking dude. And I think that really kind of perfectly works. So, I mean, obviously by the time I watched this, I was a full grown adult, but like, if anything, like, I completely get why this guy is scary. And he's just this like weird ass stranger, you know, and I could definitely understand that for sure. I think with Reggie, though, so, like, you know, Don Coscarelli based this character on his friend. He actually wrote the role for Reggie Bannister. They then twisted the character into different directions. He was designed to be kind of the everyman, a loyal friend, and the comic relief. But I think Reggie is always, yeah, he is kind of that, like, other person who I think if you're not the kid, you can kind of see Reggie as somebody who, you know, which is why he's in a bunch of these other movies. You're able to kind of latch on to him because he's this ice cream man who kind of goes and kicks his, he kicks some ass, which is kind of nice, super fun. And yeah, I do like Reggie. I think he's a cool character. And I also like the fact that, you know, when we find out at the end that, you know, actually Jody is kind of, or not Jody, but yeah, Jody's dead and Mike is sort of kind of orphaned at that point, like Reggie takes him in and is taking care of him. And I kind of want to see the rest of these movies to see where that relationship goes, because I have not seen the rest of these movies. I'm sure it's a journey to watch them, so, but I would be kind of interested to see about that for sure. And then, yeah, I mean, like, there's not a ton of other characters that I would feel like talking about or anything, because I don't think there's anyone else worth of, like, you know, note or whatever. But I do think, like, if anything, like, I do generally believe in this movie, and I can kind of suspend my disbelief and take it all in. And I really do think, like, yeah, I think the themes that people kind of extrapolate from this of, like, loss and grief, I can definitely understand because it is so embedded into the story. Like, the whole thing takes place at, like, a cemetery and a mausoleum and all of this. And I can really kind of, you know, it's interesting to kind of go into that world and be able to kind of, like, create this horror story out of it, which I just thought was, you know, pretty interestingly done. And yeah, I mean, of course, because I've also said before, too, like, one of my favorite television shows is, like, 6 Feet Under. And that whole movie, that whole show is about, like, you know, a whole funeral home and a family that owns it. So it's like, you know, being able to get into that kind of thing, you could have that morbid curiosity, those morbid questions that come up sometimes, just how people live their life and how, you know, their lives end, whether intentionally or not. But, like, you know, I just think that's really cool. And I also just like how, you know, Don Coscarelli wasn't afraid to kind of dig into that in a way, or be able to craft a horror surrounding that. Because I think such a big horror, a big fear that people have is just the idea of death itself. And what does that look like? And, you know, is it to be feared, or is it to be embraced and celebrated and all of this, you know? So I think that's definitely there. But yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to think of anything else I can kind of pull from in terms of this. But really, I don't have a ton of other things to say about Phantasm in particular. I think if I was to really say anything more, I think this movie is just very... It's a unique film to me. It is something where I personally think it's very pretty and well, you know, well shot, if anything. The remastered version of this looks really, really good. And I do tend to buy into the kind of what they're trying to sell me of this, like, kind of weird dream logic, you know. I buy into it, and I kind of like that. Yes, they use the Phantasm theme a couple different times in the movie. They use it at the beginning and the end, I'm pretty sure, but, like, I don't care, it's fine. But, like, it's one of those things where I am just fascinated by it, and I really just think, like, this is a movie that I can definitely understand people having influence, you know, in their own work from this film, because it did come out right around the late 70s. I talk about this in a future episode I'm doing, where I actually just recorded that today. It'll come out next month. But, like, how much I love 80s horror, and I just think it's really interesting, like, how, you know, this is a little bit of a precursor to that, but then, of course, you know, the other sequels in this movie came out near in the 80s pretty much, so it kind of ratcheted up that much more. But I do think this is a movie where it is a kind of beloved classic at this point, for people, and I do think it does have a bit of a cult following, because not everybody bangs with Phantasm like that. But if you're a horror fan, I think a lot of the times you will, but, you know, regular audiences are not necessarily going to buy into this movie. They're not going to maybe like it as much, but I do think the horror community does enjoy it generally, or a fair amount of people do at least, which is cool. But I do think this movie is just, like, something that is very unique. It's very, it feels like a fucking nightmare and a dream. And I'm very into that, you know, and I don't think it overstays its welcome, really. Like, I think it gets in and gets out pretty much. And I can really get into that personally. And I just think this movie is fairly well done, you know. It's not gonna be for everybody, obviously. I totally get it, but also I think this is a movie that, like, again, as if you listen to the show, it's kind of a thing of like would I own this kind of a thing, and I feel like I would own me a copy of Phantasm just for the vibes, you know what I mean. Not sure if I'd maybe own the other sequels, perhaps, don't really know about that, but it does make me want to watch the other sequels. I did watch a little bit of Phantasm 2, but I did not finish it, so I want to give myself a chance to actually watch all of the films and kind of give myself that opportunity to experience them all. But yeah, I think this movie, it does a good job at being what I think it's trying to be, and I think it does pretty well, so I'm down with that. And I can always appreciate a movie that tries to understand its assignment and does it on a pretty decent level. So, and I think that's Phantasm for sure. And it's also fairly accessible to find, so I think it is, generally, it has been on Shudder before. I'm not really sure if it's on Shudder right now, but I believe it might be, which is cool. This has definitely been covered on The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob, which is always cool. But this has also been on, like, I believe it has been on Tubi before, so that's always nice to have that. I watched it on Peacock, so that was nice. I didn't have really any ads, which was cool. But it's on the Roku channel, it's on Tubi, like I said. It may not be on Shudder right now, but it has been on there before, so who knows, it might come back. Some of the sequels I think might be on there too, but those are on Tubi. I would maybe watch those on Tubi. You watch the whole fucking thing on Tubi, it's great. But yeah, I think it's fairly accessible to watch, and just give yourself 90 minutes to watch it. You know, I think it's always a fun time to do. But yeah, I think that's everything I can think of for Phantasm. But again, happy 45th anniversary, Phantasm. You made it this far and hope you keep going, of course. They're not going to make any more movies, I don't think. But I think the legacy of this movie has been just felt throughout the years. And I am happy to have covered it on my show. But as we always do at the end of the show, so... If you would like to follow the show on social media, you can do so at Cult Cinema Circle on Instagram, where I post, like, you know, what I'll be covering for the next week. And, like, I post stories that I find on Instagram that other people have posted or posts that people have put on, whatever. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Cult Cine Circle, and also on Letterboxd at Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, Kremp, K-R-E-M-P, all one word. You can see the movies I've been watching, maybe a stupid little review I put up, or like whatever the hell. So yeah, you can also email me at cultcinemacircle@gmail.com in case you want to get in touch with me, talk about movie recommendations, or if you want to like be a guest on the show, or you want to get feedback on the show, or whatever the hell. I'm open to all of it. You know, you can email me. But yeah, that's how you can get in touch with me on social media or by email. And then also, please, you know, rate, comment, subscribe, give 5 stars on your podcatcher of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, whatever you find me on. You know, give me a rating, a 1-2 sentence review, you know. Only 5 stars here, of course, but yeah, it gets more people to see the show, and it gets me to talk about movies I like and enjoy, maybe that I don't always enjoy. It depends, but I get to talk about this cult cinema that I just find so fascinating and interesting. So that gives us a wrap to this episode. Now we're going to talk a little bit about next week's episode. So next week's episode, we're going to be covering a little movie from 1999. As you can see, there's a trend here. But I'm covering a little movie that is like a Western cannibal horror comedy movie, quote unquote. We're covering Ravenous from 1999 next week. So that is going to be super fun. I have a great guest for that. So we had a wonderful conversation. So yeah, if you don't know about Ravenous, go listen to the episode next week. But pretty much it's about Guy Pearce gets sent to this military base in the middle of nowhere after an act of cowardice at his current military base, and some shit goes down when an unexpected visitor played by Robert Carlyle comes into the base, and shit goes down. Okay, it's cannibal shit, you know, that kind of stuff, some weird shit. Okay, but go listen to my episode about it next week. It'll be a super fun time for sure. And I think that's everything I can think right now. But as always, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the Cult Cinema Circle podcast. And remember,
you play a good game, boy, but the game is finished. Now you die.
Take care. Bye.